Well, we are going to begin our session on Central America. Thank you for, again, coming and your participation here. We are Phil and Mavis Anderson. Mavis is with the Augsburg College Center for Global Education in Minneapolis, does travel seminars primarily to the Central America region. I was working in Central America as the representative for the Lutheran World Federation Department of World Service for the last 4 years, and have had a lot of contact there for the Lutheran Church since 1980 throughout all of Central America. Today, first of all, we want to give thanks to Holden Village and to all staff for having us here. We leave the village today. We're saddened by that. And then we also want to thank you who have sat in on these sessions. I would wish that the kind of dialogue that does take place here at Holden could be the kind of dialogue we can foment in our congregations. Maybe that's another thing that we can take back, try to promote this kind of open debate that we see here. Also, a word of thanks to many of you who have visited the Central America region, who do write your congresspeople, and the many, many ways that you've opened your doors, both personal homes and communities, churches, to receiving Central American refugees who bring a word of reality about what's taking place there. The word of many people in Central America, particularly El Salvador, has been that North Americans have saved a lot of lives. That's the word of Bishop Medardo Gomez over and over and over again, is that we're not for the way in which North Americans at times can intervene, calling Congress people at times of death threats and the like. Many lives have indeed been saved. Last night's forum was entitled, Can the World Afford America or the United States? I was impressed and with your comment last night is that that's not really even a question for people in this country with whom you work, people who receive welfare and the like. I also thought that that's a comment that could be applied to Latin America, that's not a question. I mean, it's already a statement. The world, Latin America, cannot afford America. However, Latin America is in, like many people, they're caught in a trap. It's a real catch-22, and there's a love-hate relationship primarily to the United States, this big monster of the North. Mexico, you often hear a phrase that the two curses of the Mexican people are that they are too far from God. That is an acknowledgement of their poverty and their plight, the fatalism of many people, but too close to the United States. And that is that the United States is seen up there as a dominant influence in all aspects of life. Another thing that you hear is that if Washington sneezes, Latin America catches pneumonia. And often that can be quite fatal. Just some look at the interdynamics of, say, taking some cases like El Salvador, of this interplay. Well, within all of Central America, only 2% of foreign investment of the United States and is in the Central America region, and only 12% of all U.S. foreign aid and commerce is carried on in the whole Latin American region. And yet, typically, of most countries throughout Central America, 80 to 90% of their exports are to the United States. And so there's a definite difference in balance of dependency, which we can look at a bit. There's an interesting case in El Salvador where at one point the United States did inject $1.5 million a day, roughly, in economic and military assistance. And for the first time in U.S. foreign policy and foreign aid history, the United States superseded 50% of a country's national budget. And so we were injecting more than 50% of their economy. That was not even the case in Vietnam during the height of our war there. So we have this massive injection in the case of El Salvador of U.S. military and economic assistance. The second highest source of income for El Salvador is coffee, about 300 and some million per year. Can anyone think of what might be then the third highest source of revenue of dollars for the Salvadoran economy? It's an interesting speculation, but it's not the case. There's probably a little bit of drug trafficking in El Salvador. It's not become a major issue. It's becoming more of an issue in Guatemala and Belize. Anybody else?
Cotton
is another major export, but it's probably around 8 or 9% of their export value.
Is it now the money that refugees send back?
Precisely. Refugees who are in the United States and Canada, Salvadorans, be they acknowledged as documented or undocumented, are sending a tremendous amount of dollars back, and that it's estimated to be over $100 to $150 million per year injected into the Salvadoran economy. You may be aware that over the last few years there's been a debate in Congress over authorizing the status of extended voluntary departure. It is acknowledging Salvadorans, Nicaraguans, Guatemalans to have for a period of time residence in the United States or refugee status in the United States. They would not be included as immigrants. President Duarte, under his era, favored the authorization of extended voluntary departure, not because of the tragedy of the war, he would say. He would trying to say that things were calming down within El Salvador, but to have people come back into El Salvador at the time of the war would have been an economic disaster. So in effect, he was acknowledging the economic relationship there. Number one, about 500,000 to perhaps up to 1 million people have fled El Salvador, and there just wouldn't have been jobs. Plus, you wouldn't have had this income. In 1988, the Lutheran World Federation and Oxfam of England did a study on the effects of 2 years of successive drought in El Salvador, particularly in the eastern part of the country. And there were two discoveries. One is that the primary way to deal with the drought would be to end the war, because you can't even begin to deal with kind of development and ecological problems unless you somehow deal with the fact that there's fighting going on throughout the war. Plus, the war itself devastates so much of the region. So trying to do forestation and the like we're just not making it when the army is deforesting. The second was that we found that the largest single income for many, many people in the eastern part of the region was what they earned or what came in monthly from relatives in the United States or Canada.
Just let me say one thing that fits in with this. 10 years ago, the city that had the largest concentration of Salvadorans living in it was San Salvador, the capital city. The second largest city was Santa Ana, which is a city in the north, and the third largest city was San Miguel, which is a city in the east of El Salvador. Now, 10 years later, the city that has the largest concentration of Salvadorans living in it is still San Salvador, the capital, which with about 1.5 million. The second largest city is Los Angeles, California. The third largest city is Houston, Texas. So that the number of Salvadorans who have fled that country either for, you know, persecution and war-related issues or just economic survival is just tremendous.
What's the total population you want? 3 or 4 million?
5 million.
Well, we might add as well that Los Angeles is the second largest Spanish-speaking city in the world after Mexico City.
Very good. Okay, we could look at just the relationship historically of the United States vis-a-vis Latin America, and probably the place where it's had the most impact definitely has been in Central America. But we want to get involved in discussion as we were yesterday and last night. 1823 is certainly a historical marker. There are probably some antecedents to that, but the Monroe Doctrine to have the European countries stay out of the Latin America region, and certainly a declaration of U.S. sphere of influence. There are many then successive leading theories or policy ways of looking at Latin America. Certainly this whole question of U.S. intervention in Latin America is number one, and the whole Caribbean and Central America region and Mexico is the primary area for this kind of intervention. It's been true in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Puerto Rico, more kind of neocolonial kinds of intervention in Jamaica, intervention, of course, in Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras now, huge military operation. We've maintained about 4,000 troops within Honduras over the last decade, kind of on a permanent basis with continual maneuvers. It's been kind of our base to operate there. Intervention in Nicaragua, intervention in Panama, Grenada in 1983. So this has been definitely the place where we have carried that big stick and really wielded that with a lot of clout. There have been periods of non-intervention, particularly under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, good neighbor policy, but then we were involved in two other spheres. We were involved in our own economic crisis here, 1929 and the like. But the idea was, well, let's take a different approach to Latin America. Alliance for Progress, quite interesting, under John F. Kennedy. I remember that era a bit, and I remember the kinds of impressions we had of Kennedy, that trying to do some good things. I joined the Peace Corps, I think, primarily because of a vision that he had. And yet, years later, we see kind of what was going on under the surface of some of this, particularly the Alliance for Progress, that it really became a base for doing counterinsurgency within Latin America. He had a plan, a 10-year plan, to inject $1 billion per year from the United States into Latin America, plus coming up with another $1 billion a year of private assistance. That really never took off and certainly was truncated. It's interesting, I just read this morning in the Seattle paper, and Bush, just a couple of days ago, has talked about an economic development plan for Latin America. The Central American presidents met last week in Antigua, Guatemala, a series of presidential summits that have been going on since 1986 in the region. And it was interesting that Secretary of State Baker was there. And he said, well, we're going to have a new approach now in Central America. Reagan is out. He didn't say that. But essentially, let's change the attitude or the approach. And the United States will kind of be the caretaker of a new economic policy of investment toward Central America. And President Cerezo of Guatemala So, well, isn't that interesting? I mean, you've been funding a war here for years and years and years, and now you want to be the broker of a new peace dividend for Central America. So it's a kind of an irony. Also, what I find interesting about Bush's plan, he is talking about U.S. investment of $100 million to put into a fund, international fund, other investors, probably primarily Europe, Western Europe, and Japan would put in another amount for a total of $300 million. It doesn't even approach what Kennedy had in mind. And that would be a major fund, part of which would be used to underwrite the debt burden of Latin America. This year, as we've mentioned, in El Salvador, at times we have put in over $350 million per year just to El Salvador. And now they're talking about a $300 million debt reduction program.
Is that besides the aid to Panama?
It would be additional. I mean, it would be just simply a debt reduction, but it, in terms of what we have been doing, it's minuscule. Mm-hmm. It's 300, well, the amount of damage the United States inflicted upon Panama in December easily is about $1 billion, if not $1.5 billion. President Endara asked for $1 billion in assistance. And the United States has come up with $500 million for this fiscal year. And also, Nicaragua was asking for $500 million, and the United States came up with $300 million. So this would be additional money, but the fact is that it's so small, really, in light of the need, and also the debt itself, which, according to the paper, Bush says the U.S. government itself has $12 billion in outstanding loans and about $36 billion in other bank loans. I don't know where they get those numbers. Those are very, very low from what I know about Latin America. They talk about at least $350 billion worth of debt, Argentina, Mexico, Brazil being the primary indebted nations. Costa Rica and Panama are probably some of the highest per capita indebted nations in all of Latin America. Quite interesting. So there are these different approaches. There was a period of dollar diplomacy, just to use some of the words that we've used and learned throughout our history, Taft, Harding, Coolidge, Wilson, protect and promote U.S. interests abroad. There I think about some of the attitudes that we have had vis-a-vis Latin America, banana republics, considering this area our own backyard. During this Harding-Coolidge era, Somoza, of course, was installed in the National Guard. Famous saying even by Roosevelt, I think it's attributed to Roosevelt and FDR, that Somoza's there with a lot of violations of human rights, the domination of the land. 25% of all of the productive land in the country was under his control. And Roosevelt acknowledged that he was an SOB, but he's our SOB. That's right. So we control it. There's now certainly a way of looking at Latin America, both regionally and still, again, our sphere of influence, and somehow we're connected to that. But also, most recently, looking at all of Latin America and Central America in the East-West or the North-South conflict, and primarily what has been going on in Central America over the last decade has been seeing this in the East-West conflict. That what we're doing here is preventing, say, another Cuba, as we see that, the Soviet influence in Cuba, which in fact has been massive, but What we often don't hear about in Cuba is the tremendous strides they've made in healthcare and literacy, education, public housing. It virtually has wiped out and full employment. Not to say that there are not problems, and it has cost the Soviet Union a great deal to maintain that. But that kind of thing would not take hold in Nicaragua to the extent that the United States saw that was taking place. Certainly, it was not going to take place in El Salvador. So we built up a whole approach to this region, confronting the Soviet Union, Cuba, Nicaragua connection. Little do we talk about the North-South global, but there is the increased awareness that the Northern Hemisphere, the wealthy nations in the South, poorer and poorer. Under President Jimmy Carter and some of the congressional people, there was a human rights era where human rights would be a qualifier for U.S. aid. And certainly there's the whole notion of national security states, Brazil being a huge example of that, that what you basically have to do is create a police and an army to quell your own national population. That's what it serves for, not the fact that you may have a war with a neighboring state or the police fight crime. They fight, basically put down unions and students and the like. We'll talk more about low-intensity conflict, perhaps lessons from Vietnam. The classic view of Latin America at the moment is this dependency economic theory, kind of the center and the periphery, that the North, primarily the United States, is the center of economic activity and everybody else swirls around the outside in a very, very dependent relationship. There is a move, certainly by some of many, many nations, very poor nations, the group of 77, for example, 77 nations, now up actually over to more than 100 nations, which has called for a new international economic order. And as you know, that has not gone anywhere under the United Nations trade UNCTAD. And the United States is the one that blocks that time and time again. We could look at the whole question of debt and the way that the United States influences the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the International Development Bank, which is part of these, and the Inter-American Development Bank in the region. We really have veto power over those organizations. And part of Bush's plan now, just unpacked, is that the debt reduction would be tied to austerity programs conducted by the IMF. Recently, Honduras has been going through a tremendous battle on that IMF business. They're basically obligated, if you're going to get loans to operate, cash, you must submit yourself to certain things like wage freezes where people won't get higher wages, and to reduce the way in which the state spends money for public services and basically allow a free market economy to run and do its thing. That may be enough for the moment. And do you want to say something now on the low-intensity conflict?
I just want to point to a book by a friend and colleague of ours, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, who is going to be here in the village next week and for the next couple of weeks. This is Jack's third book. This one is specifically on U.S. foreign policy. It's called War Against the Poor, Low-Intensity Conflict, and Christian Faith. And his first book, some of you may have heard of, was Hunger for Justice, just an excellent Christian expose of justice and injustice, specifically partially at least Latin America, but more worldwide. This is really an excellent, excellent book, and I'm sure that if the bookstore doesn't have it displayed right now, they will have when Jack gets here next week, or he arrives today, actually. Somebody in our session yesterday, I believe, read one of the quotes that Jack has at the beginning of this book, and I think it's worth reading again. It's by General Maxwell Taylor from U.S. Army. As the leading have power, we, the United States, may expect to have to fight to protect our national values against envious have-nots. And that statement seems to be the basis upon which our foreign policy has been developed over the past years. Jack also talks about some of the lessons that we learned from Vietnam. At the end of the 60s, when we were finally out of Vietnam, it seemed to have been a time when the United States could have taken on a stance of repentance for the war in Vietnam, for the death and destruction caused there, but that's not the track that we took. Instead, we took those lessons from Vietnam that we learned there from our defeat in that war and forged them into a new policy of low-intensity conflict, which we then imposed upon the rest of the Third World nations, especially Latin America. Repentance seems to be usually the last thing that's in our mind as a North American nation and people. Jack lists five or six lessons that we learned from Vietnam and that became components of low-intensity conflict, and I would just like to quickly go through those. The first one is to improve military capacity, and that's the capacity to intervene effectively in third world nations, third world settings. The second, we needed to conduct wars that were cost-effective and would win the hearts and minds of the people. The strategy of low-intensity conflict is not simply to gain control over territory, but it is to win the hearts and minds of the people who are living in this territory. It's a psychological operation. Again, here's a quote. This is from a field manual produced by the United States Army. Psychological operations involve the, quote, planned use of propaganda and other psychological actions to influence the opinions, emotions, attitudes, and behavior of hostile foreign groups in such a way as to support the achievement of U.S. national objectives. That's used very widely in El Salvador, for example. There's a division of the military there called Civic Military Action. And we'd have meetings with these people when we were there with delegations, and they'd talk about all the wonderful things that they do for the people who live in the conflicted zones. But in essence, what they do is the army goes through, burns out an area of the country, destroys the crops, kills the cattle, burns down the homes of the civilian population, and then civic military action comes in with aid to rebuild, with food for these people whose crops they have just destroyed. And they go so far as to go into some of the communities with clowns and balloons, and they bring them toilet seats, which is probably about the last thing that campesinos out in the countryside need, but that's one of their tactics. They come in with corn and beans and big megaphones, loudspeakers, and they come into the community and they ask people to come to the center to receive their allotment of corn and beans. And the interesting response of a lot of the communities is that everybody goes into their homes and closes the door. And the army literally has to go door to door to get the people to come out to get their rations of corn and beans. But the suspicion of the army is so, of the people against the army is so great that they, in many cases, resist this. Another thing the army asks is, let's call a meeting. Where are your leaders? We want to, have the leaders call a meeting in this community. Well, the people are smart to that, too, because what that is going to do is identify the leaders of the community. So they, we don't have any leaders. We're not organized. So they're wise to the tactics. At any rate, this psychological tactic is one of the major ploys used against the people there. Lesson three, let others do the dying. There was a lot of uproar in the United States when we sent our own troops into Vietnam. So the tactic now is to provide the money, to provide the ammunitions, the helicopter gunships, the guns, the M16s, but then let the Salvador training of the army, professionalize the army, but then let the Salvadorans do the dying on this. And that's what the Salvadorans say so clearly, and I said this yesterday, but their comment about low-intensity conflict is that It may be low visibility conflict for those of you in the United States, but here in El Salvador, it's total war. You provide the guns, we provide the bodies. That's part of the tactic of it. Or to manage repression and terror, part of the training of the troops and of the Salvadoran troops is how to use repression to control the people. Bombing of civilian populations in the countryside where you, what they call drain the sea. You bomb out the areas where civilians live, force them to evacuate the villages and their homes, take away the bases of support for the guerrillas who may be operating in that area, and take away their food supply. But what the effect that this has upon the civilian population is terror. And it's interesting, we didn't start talking about human rights very much in El Salvador until late 1983, when more or less the popular organizations had been destroyed, decimated, and the civilian populations had been terrorized. Well, then we start talking about human rights. But the effect of that period from 80 to 83 had already taken its toll. And you could start talking about human rights then, but the people don't forget what the army is capable of, what had happened to them. So they're well aware that if they start organizing again, this same structure is in place and the same thing can happen again. So then all you have to do is pick up a couple of people, hold them in detention for a couple of days, threaten them. The message is very clear, and you, just by implication or by the people's memory of what happened in those years in the early 80s, they are controlled. Lesson 5, redefine victory. This is especially true in Nicaragua. There were several definitions of victory that we would accept in that country. The first obviously would have been an overthrow of the Sandinistas with our being able to impose upon the country a government that's in favor of the United States goals. Well, ultimately, that's probably what happened. But in the short term, a second effective result would have been to make the people suffer. So we created the Contras, we put pressure on the international lending communities, we set up an economic blockade. The effect of all of this is to make the Nicaraguan people suffer enough so that they become disillusioned with the revolution, so that the Sandinistas had to redirect their resources away from the educational programs, the health programs, the land reform programs, put their resources into defense, and again, the people suffer, the people move back, step back from their support of the Sandinistas. Lesson 6, let's see, there's, okay, another definition of victory that we used in Nicaragua was we were putting this kind of pressure on them and we were militarily threatening them because they were connected with the socialist countries, with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europe bloc. But specifically because of those pressures that we put against the people, the blockade, the pressures on the international lending organizations, we forced them to be dependent upon the Eastern Bloc countries. Nicaragua wanted to have a broad-based economy and have relations with Western countries as well as Eastern. We blocked that kind of aid and relationship with the Western countries, so Nicaragua then, out of desperation, turned more and more to the Soviet bloc countries, and then we could say, see, we told you so. But it's from our own actions that forced them into doing that. So that's another way that we would define victory. Lesson 6, deceive your own people. Jack talks about a campaign of disinformation that we have here in the United States in which our media goes along with the goals and the propaganda of the administration in order to smear those people who do not fit into our foreign policy. I think of an example. I was with a delegation in Mexico in, I think it was 83, might have been 84. And you may remember there was an incident where there was a Soviet steamer, a ship that was on its way to Nicaragua, and we spread all over the front pages of our paper that this steamer was carrying MiGs, parts to build MiG airplanes in Nicaragua. While we were sitting in Mexico in 2 days to be leaving for Nicaragua, and obviously the fear that caused within this delegation that I was traveling with was quite intense, and actually a couple of people decided not to continue on to Nicaragua because the United States was threatening, if there are MiGs on this ship, you know, we are ready to attack.
It was 84, and it was just before the elections Nicaragua.
Strategically timed also. Well, we went on to Nicaragua. The steamer arrived. It didn't have MiG parts on it, but the damage had been done all across our newspapers. This had been flashed for days and days. And then a few days later, if you look on page 17 down in the bottom right-hand corner, you might see a little note that says, no, this wasn't MiGs that were in there. But the disinformation had happened, and in my opinion, it had happened intentionally. Anyway, that's the kind of thing you find in this book, and I would encourage you, if you're interested in looking more at U.S. policy vis-a-vis Latin America, that you get Jack's book. He also outlines some questions in the first part of his book that I think might help us to frame a discussion here, if I can find them. In his experience in Latin America and I think in ours too, we would pose these as questions also. For example, why would the United States publicly condemn terrorism while at the same time create, fund, and direct the Contras in Nicaragua, whose principal tactic was terrorism against civilians? Why did the United States work to undermine regional diplomatic initiatives such as the Contadora and Arias peace plans, which would have achieved goals publicly stated by the Reagan administration, such as no foreign military bases in the region? If the U.S. were firmly committed to democracy, then why was Central America policy carried out against the wishes of the U.S. people and through clandestine and often illegal channels? In what ways did U.S.-supported elections in El Salvador and elsewhere in Central America serve undemocratic purposes? And an interesting one, why was liberation theology, which seeks to awaken the dignity and hope of the poor, considered subversive and dangerous by low-intensity conflict planners, while religious philosophies that tolerated earthly misery and promised heavenly rewards received broad support? Maybe we can use those as some of the things that you might want to comment on in our discussion time.
Couldn't we use Russia in the same manner if you used the United States in that same?
In Central America specifically, or elsewhere in the world?
In Central America.
Not really. That's the image that I think the United States has tried to promulgate, there's no doubt, and a number of things go on there. Number one, Soviet Union geographically is quite a ways away, and it has never had the kind of insertion that we have. It's not to say that the Soviet Union is not interested in the region. It is, and it has a major embassy in Mexico City and good, I would say, diplomatic relationships to a number of countries. And they have scholarship programs, for example, for a lot of students throughout Latin America. And they've taken advantage of that. Cuba, again, is an example. I'm really, I admire very much the kinds of strides that they've made in medical work. One example is surgery on the eye, which is far and away exceeds even the kinds of surgery that is done in this country. And part of that has been the kind of assistance they've gotten from the Soviet Union. But it has never had that kind of influence. It is true that Cuba is the primary example of that relationship. The Soviet Union never, and the Eastern Bloc countries, I don't believe ever exceeded something like 20% of all foreign assistance to Nicaragua throughout its the last few years, and the primary foreign assistance have come from the Scandinavian countries, primarily Sweden. It's the number one provider. Canada is also a major aid source for Nicaragua. And many of the other Western European countries, though in the later years, like in 1984-85, the United States' influence has been so great that even, say, West Germany, which maintained good bilateral relationships to Nicaragua, began to cut, and they cut all the way back to zero. But the Soviet Union does not wield the kind of influence throughout the region that I think that we've perceived. What does it, there are liberation movements. Now, Nelson Mandela was quite interesting. There's a tape here. I hope that people can take a look at that in the next few days. One of the things that he said in there very clearly, Nelson Mandela was talking about his alliance with the PLO, Yasser Arafat, with Gaddafi in Libya, and Fidel Castro in Cuba. And this was on Ted Koppel's Nightline. And someone challenged him with regard to that. And Mandela's response was enlightening. He said, "Don't assume that your enemies are our enemies. And don't, you know, put that on us. You know, we will define who can be and who are our friends." Latin America has never really had the opportunity to work out much in the area of, say, a more democratic, socialist kind of model, though overall that's probably where most of Latin America would like to move, kind of a democratic socialism, which is more like Sweden and Norway. Germany at some times of its history. But and you do find small communist parties throughout Latin America, Colombia, throughout Mexico, throughout Central America, but they've always been small parties without a lot of real tremendous impact. They garner 1-3% of the votes in any elections, at best. So they may have played around with those kinds of things, and the Nicaraguan government of late has said that it is Marxist-Leninist. And Leninism, as I understand it, is the domination, in fact, kind of a vanguard party trying to forge the nation, very heavy-handedly, you might say. That has not worked, and I'm sure that was one of the backlashes within Nicaragua. In fact, the Sandinistas now acknowledge that they had lost touch with their own base with that kind of an approach, top-down. It doesn't work, even though much of their own rhetoric and philosophy from the outset had been to try to promote work at the level of the base. I was in Nicaragua for 3 months with World Council of Churches, National Council of Churches, USA, Latin America Council of Churches, and Lutheran World Federation observer group for the elections. I headed that delegation of 25 people, and it was admirable to see the way in which the whole election process went about. But you could see this rift between the party, the government, and some of the bases. But the domination of the Soviet Union just is not a reality anywhere in Latin America.
I'm really failing to understand why our government is so blatantly trying to come up with excuses to be at war with somebody. I don't understand that at all.
Well, can we talk about that? What insights might people have?
It fuels our economy.
Very good. That's one very, very primary reason?
Well, it's an interesting thing, too, because a lot of the weapons that were produced during Reagan's military buildup were actually used for the first time in Panama. The stealth bomber had its debut in the Panama invasion.
Okay.
So it's an interesting shift in emphasis with the weapons that were used supposedly against the, built supposedly for use against the evil empire.
Mm-hmm. We have them, we have to use them. We have to play with them, huh? Mm-hmm.
They've got a whole new set of toys.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was just going to say something along that line of how the military is so big and how it has to sustain itself. I mean, it's like mm-hmm. a whole entity that doesn't exist to do nothing.
I think one of the things the two of you have really made clear to me this week is how racist this, you know, we just wouldn't tolerate any of this kind of stuff happening in our own country. You know, vague ideas here mm-hmm. and there as I've seen mm-hmm. and tried to read and be involved, but it is so blatantly clear that, you know, we do this better than and view others as less than, and mm-hmm. we can tolerate the law. You know, I mean, these, mm-hmm. what's the loss of another 20,000 else?
Mm-hmm. There's an article, and I wish I had it along, but it's based on the quote by an embassy person several years ago in El Salvador who was caught by the press talking about the little brown men in El Salvador. And we come there and show them how to do it. But literally in public, he said, well, they're just little brown men.
Yeah. This economic question is a major thing, just to respond to that a little bit. Certainly, for example, U.S. aid, Agency for International Development, and the kinds of investments usually come right back in terms of benefit to the United States. And most studies on it show that we gain 2 to 3 times as much as we invest by this. There's a very, very good book called Open Veins in Latin America in terms of the exploitation, economic exploitation of Latin America. I don't know if any of you are bankers or economists, or at least probably, like all of us, we're tied in some ways into this economic world. And the United States, either as a government or through private banks, has lent a lot of money to Latin America, fueled by petrodollars primarily over the last 20 years, 15 years. The United States and those private banks don't care really about getting a return on the principal, that it is enough to get that interest back and to keep that debt increasing. And so this whole question of debt reduction now, be interesting to analyze that. What's the motive? What really will be the effect, if in fact it has any impact at all? I can't even imagine $300 million having any impact on the region. But yet it comes across as the benevolent, generous U.S. Yeah. Yes, there's a comment here.
In our lines, our many lines of leadership in our beautiful country, can we hope for some changes?
Well, let's talk about that, because I guess that is the question. Where can we find some changes? Huh?
You know, we think of our president being very moralistic, having all these idealistic things about fairness and justice for people. I just can't understand how it can be so rampart.
Okay.
Are we very stupid about the leadership we vote into our country, or what? You know, how can we do something about it as individuals?
How many of our congressmen and all of those, how many of them are poor?
Yeah, kind of an answer to that. We don't vote, for the most part, our politicians into power for what they do for people in Central America. It's what they do for us.
Mm. How can we get this message to the people that we all are to make the change in our voting?
The other thing is that we don't vote for the government specifically. You vote for the for the people who are in the leadership positions, we vote for Bush, but we don't appoint his cabinet. And if you look at Reagan, the people who were in Reagan's cabinet were basically big businessmen.
Yeah. Here's a comment, and then over here, and then over
right.
One, two, three, please.
I just go along with what you're saying as far as that there doesn't seem to be leadership in our government. The people that we elect seem to be reacting to the headlines as much as anybody else. I don't really see them as leaders, as people with vision.
Okay.
If you really want to feel helpless, it's at times when you read the statistics on how the lobby machinery works and how various businesses have their paid, talented people in Washington. I mean, Washington is just full of really talented lobbyists. And for us to push our view onto our elected representatives, we just have to be so mobilized to make that happen. It's scary.
Can I just interject one thing in terms of the invasion of Panama? It's quite interesting that we have the base of the Southern Command, includes the Southern Army, which base to deal with all of Latin America. The head of the Southern Command, who was there up until October of last year, was a man who spoke Spanish, understood Latin America. I mean, he was kind of considered somebody knowledgeable. And he was always against an invasion into Panama to deal with the Noriega question. Then he was removed, and a new person was put in who did not speak Spanish, Powell, and does not have experience in Latin America. Within a matter of 2-3 weeks, we invaded Panama.